Against the Grain. Since its inception, one of the main preoccupations of the Federal Bureau of Investigation has been Black Rebellion in America. From the early days of the Harlem Renaissance until at least J. Edgar Hoover's death in 1972, the FBI has had a fascinated fear of African American literature. I'm Sasha Lilly. William J. Maxwell and I will discuss how the FBI extensively surveilled Black writers and how, in turn, African American literature was shaped by an awareness of the dangerously intrusive eye of the FBI. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The Federal Bureau of Investigation's infiltration, surveillance, and repression of the left and the Black Freedom Movement under COINTELPRO is fairly well known. But only recently has the extent of the FBI's surveillance of African American writers been brought to light, which started in 1919 and was directed for decades by J. Edgar Hoover. As my guest today has gleaned from some 14,000 pages of formerly classified documents, the FBI monitored and harassed writers like Claude McKay, James Baldwin, Richard Wright, Sonia Sanchez, and Nikki Giovanni. William J. Maxwell teaches English and African American Studies at Washington University, and he's the author of FBIs, How J. Edgar Hoover's Ghost Readers Framed African American Literature, published by Princeton University Press, which has won an American Book Award. Bill, let's begin with this. Tell us the degree to which the FBI surveilled African American movements, organizations, and leaders in the 20th century.
Yes, that is a broad question with a broad answer, but it's the most important context for the book, I would say. I mean, I think what was first discovered as the civil rights movement sort of succeeded to the extent that it did, and then was replaced by the Black Power movement, and then the revelations, the immediate revelations about CIA and FBI spying on dissident groups. People began to discover all sorts of evidence of the FBI's, let's say, negative interest in Dr. King and the rest of the civil rights generation. Right? The revelation that he was being bugged, for instance. The first wave of disclosures about COINTELPRO programs that were, you know, counterintelligence programs. That phrase was initially used against communists in the 1950s, but then by the late 60s, early 70s, it was used against so-called black hate groups. That was the first wave of revelations about the intensity of the FBI's opposition to what we might think of as completely legitimate progressive black politics. Following that, which is unveiled late 60s, early 70s, you have historians and sociologists and journalists digging into the prehistory of that conflict between the FBI and black groups. And so you have folks looking at the FBI's interest in the March on Washington movement during World War II and its large file on the NAACP, another quite legitimate black organizations. So then the second wave sort of takes the story back all the way to J. Edgar Hoover's arrival at the Bureau as a very young lawyer. He's only 24 years old in 1919 when he's tasked with leading this group called the Radical Division, which is in fact the Anti-Radical Division. So you can say that from the time of the Harlem Renaissance, 1919 on, all the way up to the end of the Hoover era, which is 1972 when he passes away, almost every progressive black organization is spied on and, on occasion, indicted by the FBI.
Well, let's go back even before the moment that Hoover joins the FBI in 1919, which is a very important period, and I want to ask you about that in a moment. But tell us about this figure, J. Edgar Hoover. He looms larger than life. Most people have a pretty negative sense about him, but in terms of his origins, most of us actually don't know much.
Yeah, well, he comes out of the federal middle class of Washington, D.C. Federal in the sense that many of his relatives worked for the federal government. His father helped to make prints and nautical charts for the federal government, in fact. So he grew up literally in sight of the Capitol building. he was born to the task of helping to nationalize government in the United States. And he's raised in Washington, D.C. at a time when it's not so much a segregated city as a segregating city, right? The process of racial separation and the stratification of Washington society is something that's happening as Hoover is a teenage boy. He goes to one of the first consciously white high schools in Washington, D.C. He walks a long way to get there. He joins a conspicuously white fraternity. These kinds of things we would associate with segregation completed, but it's actually an ongoing kind of active affair for Hoover when he's young. He goes to George Washington Law School, and he works at night at the Library of Congress. And as a number of historians have pointed out, he takes a lot of those cataloging innovations that distinguish that library into his work with the FBI. So in addition to everything else, all the myths associated with Hoover, we have to say that he was a genius at bureaucratic organization, sort of born to the task, and somebody who brought library procedure into FBI record keeping, which is going to be significant later on when he's in part opposing black literacy and black literature.
So in 1919, J. Edgar Hoover joins the FBI at a time of heightened radicalism in the U.S., the artistic fluorescence of the Harlem Renaissance,
right,
and then great repression. Tell us about this moment.
Yes. Well, I mean, the center of the story is what's been called the Red Summer of 1919, and the color is used as a designator because there was blood in the streets. There were many bloody race riots, which involved essentially white mobs entering black neighborhoods after trumped-up conflagrations in places like Chicago and D.C. In fact, Hoover witnesses some of the Red Summer race rioting in D.C. as he's on his way to work. And his immediate task at the Radical Division is to keep this kind of thing from ever happening again. The Red Summer also refers to the fact that this is the immediate wake of the Russian Revolution. So you have some of the first sort of self-consciously communist additions to the American labor movement. And from the get-go, the FBI sort of conflates black rebellion, communist rebellion. And Hoover is one of the first members of the FBI organization that's tasked with sort of tamping this stuff down.
What are the origins, then, of Hoover's preoccupation with African-Americans and African-American literature? Maybe it's a self-evident question given the politics that he came out of, but what was he so afraid of?
What was he so afraid of? I mean, he's afraid of literary competition, among other things. He's afraid of a lot of things, right? You know, with great power comes great fear, I guess we can say. But, you know, Hoover is afraid of literary competition for this reason. The FBI, when it comes under his control increasingly in the 1920s, right, he's named the bureau director in the mid-1920s, has to justify itself to a pretty skeptical public. You know, the United States did not have a tradition of a national police force. And particularly after some of the FBI's moves in the Red Summer of 1919 were exposed critically to Congress, right? There was real sort of suspicion of the FBI. So one of the ways that the FBI traditionally, and Hoover in particular, goes on to justify itself is by becoming masters of literary propaganda. So Hoover has hundreds of articles, perhaps thousands, I've never done a full count, that are attributed to him, that are published in all sorts of mainstream magazines, that narrativize the FBI, that turn FBI adventures into popular crime stories. This starts as early as the 1920s. He starts putting his name on books in the 1930s. So at a very basic level, when it comes to a competition around literary power, the FBI is worried by the emergence of black literature as a rival to its own literary authority.
What was Hoover's and Hoover's FBI's relationship to the New Deal in the 1930s?
Right. Well, I think people have assumed, you know, rightly, given the FBI's sort of participation in the Cold War, it's, let's just say, voluntary participation in the Cold War, have assumed that it's a radical conservative organization. And in many ways, under Hoover, it was. But in the 1930s, Hoover is very much in sympathy with the New Deal attempt to bureaucratize the American state, to extend federal power for progressive purposes. He's a capital P progressive in the older sense, someone who believes that, this is the young Hoover anyway, someone who believes that government should be more rational, it should be more progressively administered, it should be administered by people who have professional training, whose power doesn't come just from, say, waiting in line as a federal employee, but rather comes from expertise, that federal employees should have college degrees. Everybody who was hired as an FBI agent had a college degree, which was a big deal when it came to American police forces. So all of this sort of large P progressivism, which is a movement of the teens and 20s associated with Teddy Roosevelt and other Republicans, sort of pours into his support of the New Deal in the 1930s. And he has a very close personal and professional relationship with FDR, who sees Hoover as somebody who can help to popularize the New Deal, whose adventures against the gangsters in the 1930s showed the strength of federal power. And FDR also liked the personal gossip that Hoover was willing to furnish him with. So there's a closer relationship between the FBI and the New Deal than many people might imagine, given its later purely conservative reputation.
During that period, what role did Hoover's FBI take in relationship to African American writers? You've mentioned on the one hand a feeling of competition in terms of propagandizing,
yes.
But on a more overtly political level, how did the FBI view black literature, black modernism in the 1930s?
In the 1930s, this is an anomalous moment in the history of the FBI's interest in African-American letters. The 1930s is a period when they do not generate a lot of files in relationship to black writers and black writing. They do begin files on people like Chester Himes and Langston Hughes and Richard Wright, who were figures we associate with black writing in the 1930s, but those files are actually inaugurated around 1940, 1941, 1942, and there's a big worry among the federal intelligence bureaucracy that African Americans are not going to continue to support the war effort. So the 1930s is this kind of anomalous period where there's relatively little interest from Hoover's FBI in African-American writing. It starts much, much earlier than that. We were talking about the ground of the Red Summer and the Harlem Renaissance, 1919, 1920s. That's when the FBI begins to monitor people like Claude McKay, to a certain extent Langston Hughes and others, as the Harlem Renaissance becomes a national movement and then a kind of international presence. But in the 1930s, there's an unusual lack of direct coverage of African-American literature, perhaps because the FBI had its eyes on so much else during this period. There are many, many files on white writers from Ernest Hemingway to John Steinbeck that are produced during that moment.
And that changed with World War II, as you say.
Yes.
And a concern about the spirit of internationalism that African-American mm-hmm. writers in the United States had. Tell us about what was happening within African-American literature, African-American politics, and then how the FBI regarded it.
Yes. Well, there is a worry, again, as I said earlier, that African-Americans are not going to participate at full pitch into the war effort because of the sense that there's something equivalent to fascism at home, namely Jim Crow in the South. And as many of your listeners will know, there's this famous slogan, right, that black radicals promulgate during World War II, the Double V campaign, right? Victory against the Nazis abroad, but also, importantly, victory against the white fascists at home, particularly as based in the South. So the very idea of black progressivism during the 1940s in the mind of the FBI is linked to this international effort, right, of the liberal democracies and the Soviet Union against fascism. And so you have folks like George Schuyler, who later becomes an important black conservative writer and thinker, who wrote one of the funniest novels of the Harlem Renaissance called Black No More, right, about a potion that makes everyone white and what that would mean for American racial epistemology. In the 1940s, the FBI has people all over Schuyler reading all his speeches, attending some of them, worried about his national audience. He's an important columnist for the Pittsburgh Courier, which was sort of African America's national newspaper during World War II, but also quite worried about his international thought and his international influence.
And that is the voice of William J. Maxwell. He's professor of English and African American Studies at Washington University, and we're speaking about his book, FBI's, I spelled E-Y-E-S. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You mentioned Langston Hughes, and I wonder if you could talk about the role that the FBI played ultimately in pursuing the African-American poet and writer in the 1950s.
Yes, I think that we know more about his appearances before the McCarthy Committee. That's become a kind of famous tale in the history of American literature, an unfortunate tale, right, that Langston Hughes, who's plain-spoken, highly witty verse, right, about everyday African-American life, had taken on an explicitly leftist tone in the 1930s. Much of that verse was sitting there waiting during the Cold War to be discovered and used against him. So he's called before, you know, under the harsh subcommittee lights, the McCarthy Committee. And he's asked basically to declare that he's not a communist, which he does in a kind of fudged way. It's not clear that he ever signed a party card, though he's very much in sympathy with the party during the 1930s. And there are literary scholars who have suggested that he retreats, right, from his own radicalism and relationship to this persecution. The FBI had a hand in providing some of these materials to the McCarthy Committee. There were strong relationships between those groups, but I don't think that we've seen the extent of the FBI's own interest in Langston Hughes. Langston Hughes' file keeps quoting again and again the idea that he says about Negroes becoming international in consciousness. So the thing we were talking about earlier about African-American intellectual life becoming increasingly worldly in the 1940s is something that the FBI hunts down through Langston Hughes. J. Edgar Hoover is particularly upset by some of Hughes' poetry that seems to be anti-Christian. And so in a larger pamphlet that he sends out to hundreds of thousands of Americans in the 1950s about godless communism, Langston Hughes is one of his primary exhibits. So in an odd way, during the 1950s, we have J. Edgar Hoover becoming one of the most important public critics of Langston Hughes.
Well, and one of the things that you argue in this book, FBI's, is that the release of all sorts of FBI files allows scholars now, scholars like you, to not only see the degree to which the FBI surveilled all sorts of literary figures, African-American literary figures, but also the degree to which those FBI agents became almost, if one can put it this way, informed critics of African-American literature, which is a very strange thing to think about. And I wonder if you could just tell us a bit more about, first, how this operated within the FBI. Who was tasked with the job of reading through all this literature? I mean, it happened decade upon decade, so obviously different figures. And what you describe as a kind of excited fear of African-American literature, almost an obsession.
Yes, I would say it was kind of an obsession. It's an example of something the FBI both feared and desired. I mean, if you go through the files, the many files that the FBI compiled on black authors, and by the way, I have put together a website called the FBI's Digital Archive, and there are 51 files mounted there, and they're high-quality PDF copies, and anyone who wants to look through them can.
You can find a link to that website on our website, againstthegrain.org.
Yes, so if you go through those files, what you'll see is that a lot of FBI bureaucratic writing about these authors is not that fascinating. It involves, you know, some devastating but, you know, finally boring information about street-level surveillance, who's coming into the apartment, who's leaving the apartment, what kind of letters is this person receiving. information about that person's imaginary or imagined communist ties. Sometimes they're real, sometimes they're not. Documentation about whether or not a writer should be put on the security index, which was Hoover's index of those who should be swept up in the event of a national emergency because of their treacherous opinion. So there's a lot of sort of police/bureaucratic documentation in these files. But then there are moments when people are assigned to actually not just read but review books for the FBI's National Library, where you have FBI critics sort of swept up into the sort of fever of the books. And in various ways, you see them take on the coloration of a literary critic, right? They become aesthetically interested in what they're reading and author these book reports that in some cases would do quite well in a college class. One example of this that I talk about at some length in the book is a review of A Raisin in the Sun by a Philadelphia FBI agent who's assigned to go and see, is there any communist content in A Raisin in the Sun?
And this is the play by African-American writer Lorraine Hansberry.
Yeah, right, by Lorraine Hansberry, that's now a staple of high schools everywhere, right? It's one of the most beloved works of the American theater, but when it emerges in the 1950s, the FBI knows that Hansberry has some radical connections and is quite worried about its supposedly communist content. And is also, this is something else the FBI was, you know, obsessed with doing, also interested in discovering whether or not there would be criticism of the FBI in the play. So it sends this reviewer to one of the tryout productions before Raisin in the Sun gets to Broadway, where it became a smash hit. But anyway, this agent sort of falls in love with the play, and if you read his review, it's clear that he's begun to identify with one of the characters, Benita Younger, who's a younger intellectual, sort of fascinated by the possibilities of African independence. And I think we can assume that this particular FBI agent had been an English major and was falling back in love with his subject as he's writing this. This is atypical, but I think it does, in certain ways, point up the fact that FBI agents who are asked to read and review materials are acting like professional literary critics. They have different interpretive protocols, but part of what the FBI is doing is producing a discourse and a literary critical vocabulary about black writing.
You mentioned a moment ago that the FBI was interested in whether the FBI was actually referenced negatively in these works. Is that because they thought it would be indicative of a certain political bent, or was it really just a sort of self-conscious obsession about the FBI itself?
A little bit of both. I mean, one of the things that I chart in the book is a kind of cat-and-mouse game that's done in a semi-public way from the very beginning of the relationship between the FBI and African-American literature. What I'm talking about is the fact that the FBI announces that it's begun filing African-American literature, if we can put it that way, through this bizarre publication it puts out in 1919 called Radicalism and Sedition Among the Negroes as Reflected in Their Publications. That's an emphatic title for you. That is officially issued. It gets into the Congressional Record. It's summarized on the front page of the New York Times. And many of the earliest sort of political intellectuals of the Harlem Renaissance read this report and know thereafter that they're being read and monitored by the FBI. W.E.B. Du Bois talks about this FBI document. James Weldon Johnson does so, actually reviews it for a black newspaper called The New York Age. So black writers know that the FBI is reading them and begin a kind of clandestine tradition of writing back against the FBI as early as the Harlem Renaissance. But by the time of, say, a James Baldwin in the 1960s, James Baldwin is saying very publicly that he's going to write this never-delivered book called The Blood Counters that's going to, quote, blast J. Edgar Hoover to the wall. And so the FBI is interested in discovering when this kind of writing is coming down the pike, if it can be prevented in various ways. It's an obsession about publicity, but it's also part of this larger war, semi-public war, between the FBI and African-American writing that begins during the Harlem Renaissance.
Give us some other examples of the awareness that African-American writers had of the FBI as a potential audience.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can read you a poem. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. So Richard Wright, who in certain ways is the central black writer of the 1940s in terms of his public success, in terms of his expatriatism and how that influences so many black writers. Even during his expatriate period, when you think he would be, you know, out from under the observation of the FBI, he becomes increasingly convinced that he's being traced overseas, which is in fact the case. The FBI and CIA had agents in Paris when he's there. So in 1949, Richard Wright writes this poem, The FBI Blues, and the first three stanzas go like this. That old FBI tied a bell to my bedstall, said old FBI, tied a bell to my bedstall. Each time I love my baby, the government knows it all. And excuse my less than perfect performance, but here goes. Woke up this morning, FBI under my bed. Said I woke up this morning, FBI under my bed. Told me all I dreamed last night, every word I said. Everywhere I look, Lord, I see FBIs. Said every place I look, Lord, I find FBIs. I'm getting sick and tired of government spies. One of the things I claim in the book is that in certain ways this is the most typical work of modern African-American literature, this little poem by Richard Wright called The FBI Blues, to the extent that it makes very, very clear, right, the extent to which black writers were aware of FBI surveillance and imagined the FBI as not the primary audience, not the most valuable audience, but in fact one major audience for black writing.
That's the voice of Professor of English and African American Studies, William Maxwell. I'll return with him in just a moment. Listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today we're talking about the history of FBI surveillance of African-American writers. I'm joined by William J. Maxwell. He's the author of FBIs, I spelled E-Y-E-S, How J. Edgar Hoover's Ghostwriters Framed African-American Literature. That's published by Princeton University Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. So you had mentioned a moment ago about Richard Wright being surveilled by the FBI while abroad. And in mid-century, African-American writers were a particularly cosmopolitan bunch. A lot of them traveled extensively and were connected to literary movements and political movements beyond the borders of the United States. To what degree did the FBI influence the mobility or lack thereof of black writers?
Well, the first thing I think we should emphasize is that we tend to imagine the FBI, and it was technically as America's domestic spy service, and the CIA, which is created in the wake of World War II as its international spy agency, which is broadly enough true, but for a long time, the FBI opposed the creation of the CIA. Even into World War II, the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover is given control of international intelligence in Latin America. And the FBI, you know, after World War II, spreads about in world capitals these FBI legal attaché officers. So there's an FBI presence abroad when it comes to America's intelligence bureaucracy that we tend to forget. In any case, the FBI is very concerned to map the international travels with so many of the post-war expatriate black authors from, you know, Baldwin to Chester Himes to to Richard Wright, who we've been speaking about. And so their FBI files double as kind of travel documents. You can see, in the case of James Baldwin, for instance, specific information about specific airplane flights, who's going to be landing where, who's going to meet him at the airport, where is he exactly in Istanbul they're interested in. And as I write about in the book, they sometimes place what were called stop notices with U.S. ports of entry, airports and seaports and so on, during this period, which did not mean that folks would be immediately arrested at the border. It would mean, however, that they could be held for extra questioning, which allowed the FBI to teach again and again to these writers that their travel was a matter of national security, that their international travels were, in fact, mapped by American intelligence. And this is something that many of them comment on. Baldwin certainly did.
And also, of course, there's not just the question of travel abroad, but then the question of would they be able to return? Would these African-American writers be able to return to the United States because of the FBI?
I talk about Claude McKay, right, who is arguably the first author of the Harlem Renaissance, who wrote this clarion call sonnet, If We Must Die, published in 1919 around the Rent Summer. We were talking about that earlier, who writes in a kind of standard English sonnet during the early years of the Harlem Renaissance, but is tremendously influential on Langston Hughes and even people like Zora Neale Hurston and others. Somebody who introduced modern themes of, you know, black anger and black self-organization into very traditional poetics. But anyway, McKay, who is an important black communist in the 1919 to 1923-24 period, goes abroad for a long portion of his career and is very much convinced that he's not going to be able to return to the United States because of FBI and other spy agencies. It's only in the 1930s when he intervenes with some of his friends with better political connections. Walter White of the NAACP is one that he imagines that he's going to be allowed to come back into the United States. So one of the things that I emphasize in the book is that our romanticization of transnational literature, particularly when it's produced by African Americans, sometimes ignores the conditions of state surveillance that made it necessary in the minds of these writers. They were definite advantages, right? And yet someone like Claude McKay is not merely a wandering bohemian, right? He's also someone who feels as if he's being haunted by American state intelligence and might not be able to return.
Right, and presumably someone like Paul Robeson, who's not...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the two most famous cases that the FBI is involved in, though they involve the State Department and other federal bureaucracies, when it came to African-American intellectuals not being able to travel, the Paul Robeson case and that of W.E.B. Du Bois, right? Their passports are actually stripped for them for certain years in the 1950s. The FBI actually was doing some of the bureaucratic legwork for this behind the scenes.
We've been talking a fair amount about the 40s and 50s, but then taking things politically through the 60s and 70s, obviously there was a whole upsurge. One could see it as perhaps a continuation of the black freedom struggle earlier, but clearly in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, mm-hmm. There was a really enormous momentum to movements, civil rights, then the Black Power movement, and you had accompanying literary movements, the Black Arts Movement in the 70s being one of them. How did the FBI respond? First off, and you mentioned earlier COINTELPRO, but if you could just talk specifically, how did the FBI respond politically to these movements, and then how did it respond to writers who were sympathetic to them and producing a great amount during that time?
Right. Well, in the 1960s, we have the most direct, most violent interference of the FBI in the African-American freedom struggle. And I think many of your listeners know some of the basic facts here. We were talking at the very beginning of the interview about counterintelligence programs that were aimed against the Black Panthers, most famously, but other black nationalist organizations. because so many of those organizations were staffed by people with literary interests, because the Black Arts Movement, which is founded at least symbolically by Leroy Jones / Amiri Baraka in 1965, right, at the Black Arts Repertory Theater School in New York City, because those folks were so devoted to making black literature a kind of helpmeet to radical black politics, the FBI found it difficult to distinguish between black radical politics and black radical literature during this period. It's also the case that in black arts writing from the 60s and early 1970s, the FBI is a major negative force, right? There's a whole bunch of poems by people like Amiri Baraka and Sonia Sanchez and Nikki Giovanni that attack the FBI directly, that make Hoover into a kind of demon, right? Which, from a certain perspective, perhaps he was. This tradition of black writers writing against the FBI sort of explodes into public view fully in the Black Arts Movement. There's a poem by Amiri Baraka called Three Movements, right, in which he says, J. Edgar Hoover will soon be dead, your mother will die, Lyndon Johnson will die. There's a whole list of what he imagines as the sort of gods of white America that that Hoover tends to typify, that he wants to take on during this period. It becomes quite overt, this larger tradition of black writers aiming at the FBI in that period.
So then thinking about how the FBI influenced the writing of African-American mm-hmm. writers, which is one of the things that you posit in your book, FBIs. So clearly there is a whole body of work by African-American writers that mm-hmm. is either directed at or referencing the FBI. Mm-hmm. Is that the main influence that you see the FBI having on this writing? To what degree is it possible to see the degree to which writers self-censored because of fears yeah. of the FBI? How do you assess that?
Yeah, you put your finger on something really important there. I emphasize explicit, overt, you know, and public tangling with the FBI on the part of black writers, in part because it is so difficult to assess self-censorship, right? If you read individual high-quality biographies of some of the figures in the tradition, like, say, James Campbell's biography of James Baldwin, okay, you're going to find pretty convincing cases that some of Baldwin's, at least fictional production in the late 60s, early 70s, was stillborn because of his fears of the FBI, which were not at all fictional, right? I mean, we have the evidence now that shows us this. Was there self-censorship there? Yeah, probably in certain ways. But there was also the production of literature in relationship to the FBI. I think on balance, it probably produced as much as it repressed. That's not to say it was a good thing or a particularly legal thing in many cases. But I emphasize the way that black writers explicitly take on the FBI because I want to evade, I guess, psychoanalyzing, right, the dead. I'm more of a materialist historian, and I want to see the literary evidence. And I think that the FBI helped to produce black writing as much as it helped to repress it.
The FBI also took on the task of creating its own instances of yeah. faux black literature that was actually yes. written by FBI agents. Tell mm-hmm. us about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that FBI agents in all of the cities where the FBI had an office, and that was a lot, that was over 50 in the 1960s, you know, St. Louis, where I live, there was a big FBI field office here, there's one in Kansas City, et cetera, wherever folks live, there's going to be an FBI field office somewhere nearby. The agents who were headquartered there were tasked, along with other things in the COINTELPRO period, with writing a kind of counter-literature, as I called it, that was there to infiltrate, to disturb, and to mislead, right, black nationalists. So some of the more famous examples of this involve a Black Panther coloring book that very likely was produced by FBI agents, which was then spread across the West Coast to help to divide the Black Power movement from itself. You had various letters that were thought to be sent from black prisoners in which they confess their participation in radical violent activities that didn't quite exist. You have snitch jacketing or the sort of false labeling of various black politicians as stool pigeons. The FBI is writing those kinds of documents, but it's also writing poems in a pseudo-black voice during this period. It's also producing entire newspapers that were thought to come from black student unions during this period, which meant that white FBI officers, and they were almost entirely white during this period, were acting as minstrels. That was one of the things that COINTELPRO bizarrely produced.
And one example of this, although not directed or not created specifically as a piece of literature, mm-hmm. is a letter that you actually begin the book with, which was directed to Martin Luther King. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Well, this is something that I think is a fairly common and well-understood moment of failure in our national life. It's something like the nadir of FBI history. This is a letter. It was sent anonymously, but we now know that it was probably written by William C. Sullivan, who was an important Hoover lieutenant in the 50s and 1960s, who actually might have inherited the FBI from Hoover had things gone slightly differently. But in 1964, Hoover is particularly incensed by Martin Luther King's having won the Nobel Peace Prize, which is an honor that improbably enough he thought he deserved in Martin Luther King's place. Other things are spinning out in the FBI's relationship to the civil rights struggle, but it looks like Hoover may have suggested to Sullivan that an anonymous letter be sent to King's Atlanta home that is, you know, written in the voice of a disappointed black civil rights foot soldier who has discovered evidence of Martin Luther King's infidelity. The FBI had been taping hotel rooms across the country and so, in fact, caught this. So they sent a package containing this letter, which is written in a black voice, to King's Atlanta home accompanied by this tape. Yeah. What more can be said about that? One of the things that I say about it in the book, that beyond its obvious horror, what you have here is something that's indicative of a longer history of the FBI's fascination with black voices, attempt to reproduce those voices. You have a certain kind of literary desire behind this act.
William Maxwell is my guest. We're discussing his book, FBI's How J. Edgar Hoover's Ghost Readers Framed African American Literature. That's published by Princeton University Press, and I'm Sasha Lilly. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So J. Edgar Hoover died in 1972. What happened to the surveillance of black writers? Did that end with him, or does it go on? Do we have any way of knowing?
Okay, well, I don't have the best way of knowing, in the sense that for the sake of historical completeness and the sake of trying to actually finish a book, I sort of cap my researches at 1972. I think there's good reason to imagine, since COINTELPRO is actually shut down during this period, as it applies to so-called black hate groups, that the worst of the surveillance was abated during that period. Some other folks would tell you it continued through other names and other agencies. I do think that something broadly has shifted, though, in surveillance culture, to the extent that we now have the NSA and similar national and international organizations monitoring data flows that are massive, that are electronic, that don't tend to emphasize the power of singular literary voices any longer. The FBI has a pretty romantic idea about the power of individual books and individual writers to affect cultural and political history. I can say broadly that I don't believe that spy agencies are worried about who wins the pushcart prize. Perhaps unfortunately for them, I don't think that there would be individual FBI agents assigned to chase Lorraine Hansberry down the street and to record what she's wearing that day, which actually happened in the 1950s. So I would say that the targeting, right, of surveillance is different now and less literary in its origin.
I wonder if you could talk about how you got access to these files and at what point have these become available. You mentioned this digital archive, which we are linking to on our website, againstthegrain.org. But what's the story of the release of these files? And do you have any sense of the extent to which there are other files that haven't been have not been released?
Well, one thing I would suggest to people, if you're deeply interested in an American or indeed international cultural figure, right, who was working in the United States or appearing in the United States during the period of the sort of FBI's high Hooverism, 1919 to 1972, I would suggest that you write away for their FBI file. Often enough, you will find that the FBI was on the case. I would say that it's sometimes the difficulty of accessing these files has been exaggerated, and that has to do with a historical shift. I don't believe that the FBI is as concerned with its Cold War records and its Cold War history as it used to be. This history is slightly embarrassing, but something that the FBI doesn't hide to the same extent that it once did. Anyway, when I began the process of collecting these files, there were a number of the most important in the public domain, or at least well-known to scholars, right? James Baldwin's file, Richard Wright's file, even Claude McKay's file had been accessed. And I looked at McKay's file when I was doing an edition of his complete poems and found it absolutely fascinating because it did suggest one of the reasons why he kept writing about Harlem outside of Harlem. He was afraid that if he returned to New York, he might be arrested, right? That's why Home to Harlem, one of the central texts and most beautiful books ever written about Harlem, New York, could not be written in the city, right, of its title. But anyway, these files are in the public domain. I decide to collect them all to the extent that I can. And so I went to the Norton Anthology of African-American Literature for, in certain ways, the straightest, most canonical vision of what African-American literature would be. And I requested all the files of all the figures who appear there between 1919 and 1972. And, you know, almost 50 documents were returned to me. Almost 50% of the figures I asked for actually had files. It's a less onerous process than you might imagine. And the FBI now has a major online presence. If you go to the FBI's FOIA division or Freedom of Information Act division on its website, there are very clear-cut instructions for requesting FBI files.
Do you think there is any lasting legacy in African-American letters now from the kind of complicated entanglement of the FBI with African-American literature, obviously through surveilling it, but as you say, it's a sort of complicated affair. Has that left any traces now? Obviously, there's more than four decades since the death of J. Edgar Hoover.
Right. Yeah, that's a tough question, but it's an important one. I mean, if we're going to return just for a second, just as a preamble, to think about African-American literature and its characteristic tropes and understandings in that period, one thing that many folks have noticed about African-American literature in a whole during this period is themes of indirection, of masking, of doubleness. Right? Anyone who's taken a college course in African-American literature will have been taught about W.E.B. Du Bois and double consciousness. One of the things I think that we can say now with some certainty is that the FBI's spying was one of the ways in which those tropes and themes were turned into modern materials by African-American writers. Right? They were not just this existential heritage from the 19th century. This was an affair of having to speak through masks and to understand that you have multiple audiences. That was very much present, right? Because the great majority of 20th century black authors knew or suspected that they were being read by the FBI, and there's an attempt to certify that in the book if you want to read those details. So I think there's more of a heritage in 20th century black writing of the FBI, even when it's not an explicit force, than I think we've seen thus far, when it comes to some of the traditional themes of indirection and masking in the black tradition. I mean, I think that one thing that will happen is that younger African-American writers who are writing in sympathy with the Black Lives Matter movement are going to assume that they are surveilled. you had last year, right, very public documentation of the way in which federal agencies, the FBI among them, private spy firms, began immediately in Ferguson and other places to track the Twitter feeds of some of the most prominent Black Lives Matter protesters, to read their electronic publications. And as we see a sort of a Black radical tradition that maybe extends from Claudia Rankine into younger Black authors, I think we're going to see a continuation of surveillance as a theme and as an understanding in Black writing.
I've been speaking this past hour with William J. Maxwell. He teaches English and African American Studies at Washington University in St. Louis. He's the author of the book which we've been discussing today, FBI's, I spelled E-Y-E-S, How J. Edgar Hoover's Ghost Readers Framed African American Literature. That's published by Princeton University Press. He's also the author of New Negro, Old Left, African American Writing and Communism Between the Wars, and he's the editor of Claude McKay's Complete Poems. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.